that night he's acting out with pornography. So I asked him, well, what did you look at? He'd had some time in therapy enough to know how to be brave with that question. Yes. And curious with it, because it might feel scandalous. Like, isn't that the very thing I'm trying to forget? And I'm actually saying, be curious about that imagery. So what he says is, I think in all, you know, that my search through pornography, what I was looking for is a woman with a really genuine smile, and just starts crying. In that moment, he's able to connect with, I wanted a kind face. That takes us even deeper.
Friends, welcome back to part two of a conversation with my good friend Sam Jolman, diving into his book, The Sex Talk You Never Got, Reclaiming the Heart of Masculine Sexuality. In part one, we began to explore this idea that our story with feminine love can perhaps be one of the greatest trailheads to recover wholehearted life in God, in His kingdom, to understand the core needs within our soul as a man that are valid in the language of attachment, the needs for safety, security, soothing, and being seen, and how that interplays with our sexuality, where we've taken it, and what's in the way of it being fully restored, fully healed, and fully matured. In the last episode, we considered together the necessity for the beauty of God to nourish us both sensually and sexually. Let's pick up the conversation there.
Toni Morrison, the writer, she said, beauty is a need.
Wow.
So sex, as we're saying, is not a need.
Wow. But beauty is a need.
Is a need. In your life, you have to have places where you aren't just in the grit and hustle and push of life, but where you're pausing to take in beauty. I mean, you think about all of the abundance of sunrises and sunsets we all have for beauty. Beauty is not just found in exotic places, right? That you have to go to Hawaii,
yes,
to go find. Beauty is everywhere. It's every day and night. It's the flowers, right, that are on the way to the mailbox.
I picked a weed yesterday in the yard, and it actually was a bit of a sage stem that was growing through the rocks. And I picked it up, and in days past, I would have thrown it, you know, in the garbage can. And instead, I smelled it. And the smell of sage is the smell of archery for me, because yeah. I began hunting in sort of sagebrush country at about 8,000 feet, and I brought it home. It's just interesting. I'm reflecting on what you're saying. I didn't even realize I was doing this or even why I was doing it, but I yeah. picked up and smelled it. It's this little weed with a root, and I was so moved by it, I brought it home and brought it into a bud vase and put it in the kitchen. And like, until this moment, I didn't even really think about what I was doing, but it was like, I needed to behold the beauty. I yeah. needed to have that smell, because I had a very intense relational day and a lot of high level navigation of people's souls and stories. Mm. And it was healing something, yeah. filling something, satisfying something. And all the while, took some pressure, as I'm thinking about it, off of my engagement with Sherry last night. And it's just an example of, it was a weed,
yeah.
right? It was something growing in the rocks that I had to deal with.
Right.
And the story I could tell myself is, there's never enough time. There's always a project. And instead, it was slow, notice, embody,
yes.
right? Be present to my body.
Yes.
Savor the smell right now. And it's not for later.
Right.
It's not for later. It's daily bread. It's essential. It's a need. And I need it today.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think as men, you know, there's obviously the how men objectify women.
Absolutely. Right? And We're all guilty of it.
Yes. And through lust and et cetera. But there's also the way men objectify themselves, which is I'm only going to work, put out, work, don't stop. And, you know, eat, sleep, repeat, work. And that sense of, you know, we live obviously in the West and we have all these mining towns, right? You think of like men working, like what harder worker is there than mining? What was in every town for the men?
Just relief, right?
Right.
It's a saloon. That's it.
And a brothel.
That's it. The entire West.
Right.
Saloons and brothels.
Sex and alcohol.
Wow.
Right? And you think about like, I have a friend, Chuck DeGroat, who's written on, he writes on the church and pastor care. And he says, you know, the thing that he sees pastors resorting to most for emotional regulation is alcohol or pornography use, right? It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
This emaciated soul lacking satisfaction
right.
for the real thing.
Right, and the need for comfort is real.
Wow.
You need comfort. You need a place where you are not always working. That's absolutely a need. But it's easy for us as men to not do what you did. I mean, that's such a beautiful story, Morgan, because it shows you naturally aren't just objectifying yourself, right? Forcing your body, forcing your being to just push through, do more work. Right. But actually seeing yourself as like, I need comfort. I mean, this is literally in the Jewish law, right? Do not muzzle the ox. Right. They knew, like, don't even objectify your animals.
Don't work them too hard beyond their load.
Right.
Wow.
Let them eat some of the grain that they're actually
treading.
And yet we don't do that in the masculine world as much. It seems women have a better capacity for this. Right. And again, I'm not saying they don't also battle their own objectification in different ways. But I think that for men, this just go, go, go. We don't have a category for sensuality, right? Mm. Like sensuality in men, what?
Mm.
That sounds so bad. But you think about men that love cigars, right? What are they loving about a cigar?
Exactly. The entire experience, right? It's not efficient, right? And it's sensual, and it's the brotherhood and the aroma. I mean, as you're saying it, I feel it in my body. I'm like, we should be having a smoke. And I'm like super into fitness and health, right? Why do I once in a while smoke cigars? But you're right. It's that there's a whole culture around it that's really good for the soul.
Right. And I'm inviting men. That might feel so tangential to sex.
Mm.
But what I'm saying is sex is a feast of sensuality, right? Sex is made to be a highly sensual experience. You think of, right, the lovers in Song of Songs. I mean, the poetry of Song of Songs is all about the sensual connections of the body to other things, right? Your navel is like a goblet of wine, right? I mean, he's connecting. Your hair is like a flock of goats, you know, coming down from Bashan. I think I'm getting that verse right. In other words, he's connecting it to all the sensual experiences he's had in his life, right? The sensuality of being a sheep herder.
Wow.
The sensuality of a goblet of
like
wine.
The cedars of Lebanon.
The cedars of Lebanon, right. So there's a sense of your sensuality is the bedrock of your sexuality. If you have good sensuality, other places of getting beauty and that soothing comfort, right? It will let you show up to sex differently, not with this push for sex has got to be the thing I get where I get beauty, right? Or relief.
It's so good. So Sam, I mean, this is really rich. And what I'm noticing as we're talking about the real thing, the good thing, the restored thing, the reclaimed thing, I don't think it's fair to go this deep without visiting shame. Because if there's any one condition that defines men and sexuality in the not yet, in the unfinished. It's shame.
Yeah.
And in your book, you have this beautiful passage where you talk about escaping shame through kindness, which I've never heard before. And it's really beautiful because you talk about the blue pill, the red pill, and this dichotomy. And as we know, in masculine initiation, as we mature, there are very few things that are dichotomous, right? Mm-hmm. It's binary. It's often the mystery of the third way, the narrow road, but here and there and now and then, there's a blue pill or red pill, and you just name it. And you say, there's only two ways out of shame. Not much is binary in life, but this one is absolutely blue pill or red pill. The most immediate flinch response we experience in the face of shame is escape with contempt. We blow up the moment, we run or hit, and stay powered up in a state of defensiveness. And you go on to say the only other option than contempt is you have kindness. We resist the flinch to run even a half a second in order to stay in the moment and recognize the shame attack. We pause to breathe. We slow down. To take a breath is to give oxygen to your body when it needs it most. Our first act of kindness. Sam, I just so appreciate that. Just a breath can be an act of kindness. We work to calm the alarm system of our bodies rather than answer its panic with escape. Tuning into your body rather than shutting down requires getting more vulnerable in the very moment you feel the least safe. It's a brave act. And then we take the risk to call shame what it is, a damn liar. We turn the tables on shame and question it. It starts with getting curious about what provoked it. Maybe it's lying to you. Maybe love is still available and you can recover a sense of safety. Leaning into vulnerability like that takes immense courage. If you don't want to handle your sexual shame with contempt, you must take a risk on love. Contempt or kindness, that's it. Responding to shame with kindness feels ludicrous or at least unfamiliar to most men. Mm-hmm. You've heard a lot of stories, and frankly, in humility, Sam, you know what works. What do you mean? And what does it look like?
Well, I'd want to start with honoring, I believe every single one of us battles some form of sexual shame. If you think about that, the introduction of shame in the whole human story is around nakedness and the covering up of nakedness, right? It is an assault against, at some level, obviously the vulnerability, right? The symbolism of nakedness, but also sexuality. So Adam and Eve, we have this false separation through chapters and verses in our Bible. But Adam and Eve, Genesis 2, closes with Adam and his wife were both naked and felt no shame, right? And it's right after Adam delivers his poetry to her. I mean, it is dripping with goodness and connection.
Let's go back. Right? I want to go home.
Yes. And I mean, there's no shame. There's no lust. There's no sin. I mean, there's no wounds. There's nothing encumbering the naked pleasure and connection of Adam and Eve. And there's a sense of we almost feel this like curtain closing, like the camera fades out and we leave these two lovers to be in the naked glory and goodness of Eden. Chapter 3 starts, now the serpent was more crafty. Right? And so we think, oh, it's a new scene, right? But if you take out chapters and verses, it literally says, Adam and Eve were naked and felt no shame. Now the serpent was more crafty. Mm. Damn it.
Yes.
Right? Like that fast, evil comes to assault the naked innocence of Adam and Eve. I believe that's true of all of our stories, that evil comes early. Evil hates your sexuality. Evil hates your sexuality. It is such a mirror that you are made for goodness and sensuality, that you're a lover, that you're a worshiper, right? That there's a God that you are going to go looking for, right? Who made all this goodness, and it's going to make you want God. So evil hates your sexuality because it's such a signpost of God's design of you for goodness and pleasure. So I want to invite you as a man, as I do in the book, to think of, you know, now Sam was naked and felt no shame. Now the serpent was more crafty. In other words, evil came into my story,
yes,
to assault my God's design of my sexuality.
Like right at the point of innocence.
Yes.
Right? Like you're saying, literally in my story, locate the innocence and the wonder and the pleasure and notice how the crafty one came in to steal it.
Right. And to introduce what? What does he introduce? What's his weapon of choice against Adam and Eve? Shame. Mm. Right? They didn't, you know, they felt no shame. It's literally how the writer ends Genesis 2. What is this magical thing that evil does to invite us to hide, cover up, accuse, right? Suddenly it all falls apart, right? They're covering up the naked glory. What? Right? They're accusing each other. These lovers have just turned on each other that fast to blame each other, right? That's contempt, right? That quickly the flinch shows up. It is so devastating to read those as, you know, a congruent passage. So I'm saying at some level, your deepest, truest sexual identity is lover. God made you a sensual being. It is a good thing in the world that you are a lover. It's going to make you fall in love with sagebrush. Mm. It's going to make you fall in love with wildflowers. It's going to make you fall in love with your wife or, you know, the beautiful experience of a holy moment of worship or God. Mm. And evil hates that. So he's going to try to give you a different name, a different sexual name even, right? I'm a pervert, right? Oh my gosh, I am such a pornographer. I'm weird. I'm so broken. I'm not attractive. I'm ugly, right? I've sat with men who will say, oh, I couldn't get a girl. I couldn't move a girl, right? Like I'm ugly. This accusation, or it could be about parts of your body. I'm short, I'm fat, I'm whatever it is that evil wants you to begin to believe is truer about your sexuality, that you're hopeless, right? Your sexuality is hopeless. You're stuck in some sexual sin or you're a monster. Or you're an abuser, whatever the word is, the different name evil hopes to give your lover heart, that's shame, right? And it may not be that spoken or feel that spoken, right? It may be just a felt sense in your body that grips you. So here would be an example of how that looks in real life. So I sat with a man and he's given me permission to share this story. He's a contractor in construction. He's driving home from work. His wife asks him to stop at the grocery store to get some things. He gets those things, gets home, realizes he's forgotten some things. She's mad. She's disappointed out of her own frustration, right? And he feels the distance, the separation that he's disappointed her. I'm a disappointment. Mm. And that night, he struggles with looking at pornography. Now, again, he's not coming into my counseling office with that story on the surface. He came in actually saying, oh, I looked at porn again. And okay, which is always a brave confession,
yes,
right? Like, okay,
absolutely.
Like we leave a little space for the bravery of that. But then the question becomes, the question I asked him is like, you know, what did you look at? Mm-hmm. What's the story? Tell me the context, right? So this is now dropping into kindness. Rather than the contempt and shame he felt, which was, I'm so screwed up. I can't ever get over this. We dropped into the story, which with curiosity of, well, what was the context that you were tempted in? There's always a context. You're not just an animal. Again, right? It's not just an overactive sex drive and, oh, you just, yeah, you know, it's hard being a man, isn't it? Sometimes having a sex drive and, you know, you act it out and, well, confess it and move on, right? Like, I'm inviting, don't waste your sin even. Like, be curious about it.
Powerful.
That's the gift of the gospel. So we get to this story of the drive home, the groceries, the things he forgot, his wife's disappointed face, the distance that that creates. That night he's acting out with pornography. So I asked him, well, what did you look at? And he'd had some time in therapy enough to know how to be brave with that question and curious with it.
And that it matters.
And that it matters, right? Because it might feel scandalous. Like, right. Isn't that the very thing I'm trying to forget?
Yes.
Right? I'm trying to forget all that imagery. And I'm actually saying, be curious about that imagery. So what he says is, I think in all, you know, that my search through pornography, what I was looking for is a woman with a really genuine smile, and just starts crying. And in that moment, he's able to connect with, I wanted a kind face.
That's what I needed.
That takes us even deeper into the ache for a woman's kind smile, the historic sense of that, and the sense that the only time he got his mother's smile is when he was giving her shoulder massages, and when she was sharing about her heartache with his father, they would have this ritual. In other words, his mother had set him up. Now we're in this story, right, of his own sexual formation, of here he is comforting his mom in her heartache about his dad. Right. And that might not feel like a sexual formation story, but this is a grown woman, his mom, bringing him her heartache about his dad, like triangulation, and the setup of him bearing the desire of a grown woman's heart as a boy. And it was the only time he got his mother's smile, her pleasure in him.
Wow.
So it was, you can start to see why that was sexualized for him. Now, is he responsible for having looked at pornography? Of course.
Absolutely.
Right? That was his choice to take it there to a place of power, right? Power as contempt versus having gone to his wife and just said, I feel like I disappointed you and I've lost you. Like, you know, bringing his desire, you know, he could have gone and worked that out with his wife, but the bravery he needed to engage his desire for a smile from a woman, right, took exploring his story and being kind to parts of his story that had shaped him and really that he had buried with shame. So this sense of, I'm only a disappointment, right? Can you start to hear that?
Absolutely.
That message over his lover's heart. So I'm inviting that kind of curiosity. I believe Jesus saved some of his most intimate, kind conversations with the sexually broken and oppressed. He sat and carried on tender conversations. You think of the woman caught in adultery, right?
It's exactly where my heart was going as you were sharing.
That's
the
good.
Kindness of the space.
Yeah, it's, I mean, he is literally casting away her accusers. And then he gets playful with her, which is like, where'd everybody go? Right? There's this sense of wink, wink, right? he's inviting her to see, like, I'm not accusing you here. And again, there is the go and sin no more.
Yes.
But it's, I'm not here to rage at you. I'm not here to pour contempt on you. I'm here to be kind to you in your sexuality.
And Sam, I'm even thinking, it's literally like a parable written for your book where here's the accused and the accusation and the accusers and this energy, violence and retribution, and Jesus gets down the dirt and slows it all down.
Yeah.
They recover their breath, and it's almost like whatever else was happening, everyone gets called into the present moment. And then even before that, I'm feeling that turning where he says, you know, you without sin, you cast the first stone.
Yeah.
And it was like he turned away from her shame and called them into their own story.
Yeah.
And their own story of sexual formation. And really, in a word, in a moment, in a pause, ask the question, what's different between you and her?
Mm-hmm.
And so all that, you just see his ministry, the depth and breadth of what he was doing. It was far more than forgiveness. It was embodied reclamation.
Yeah, right. A man version of that, when he meets a man, I think of the wild man, the naked wild man, mm-hmm. of the Gadarenes,
mm-hmm.
right? As another scene of, again, it may not appear overtly sexual, right? Like it's not sexual sin,
right,
that he's being caught in, but here's a naked man running around in the wilds, right? Something's oppressing him. And again, this is my therapist hat a little bit reading that story.
Yeah.
It's not in the text, but you know, brokenness usually follows stories. So why is this guy naked, right? What's the oppression against this man that he's literally, I mean, they try to chain him up and he's breaking chains. He is an oppressed, broken man. And he comes running up to Jesus screaming, right? And the disciples are like, what is going on here? Jesus addresses the oppression, the evil oppression first.
Right. Not even the man, the oppression in the man.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Sets him free. And the beautiful thing is, I mean, the scene is so wild that the people run. I mean, there's a sense the disciples flee, right? With the people, because they're running back to the town. Like, what just happened? When they come back, there's this beautiful scene where it says, they found Jesus talking with the man who was clothed and in his right mind.
Wow.
Talking to Jesus. Why does it say that Jesus was talking with the man? Mm. Right? It's not just that he cast the evil out of him, but he sat and had a conversation with the man. And, you know, I don't know what they were talking about, but I imagine, you know, it might have been about this man's story. Like, how did he get here? How did he get to this place of such oppression?
Mm.
Right? But the fact he was clothed, right? There's a restoration of his dignity and the intimacy of a conversation. I find Jesus to be so full of kindness and so full of curiosity for people in general, but particularly the sexually broken. And I think I know he has that same kindness and curiosity for you. He doesn't want to rage at you. He doesn't want to condemn you. He wants to sit with you. And that might feel scandalous. Welcome to the gospel, right? It is the scandalous invitation of God.
So Sam, we're circling back yet again to these banner words of kindness and curiosity as it relates to ourself and our story. So getting practical and operational, what does it look like? As you have my attention with my sexual story, my story of sexual formation, what does it look like to live into more curiosity?
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things come to mind. one right away is, literally to sit down with a piece of paper or the notes app on your phone and just write out, you know, bullet point form. What are like 10 things that shaped your sexuality?
Mm.
What are 10 memories?
Wow.
That, you've maybe not sat and reflected on, but just make a list of 10 things that have shaped your sexuality. You know, that could be the beautiful and innocent, like a first kiss, or it could be the painful, like a story of sexual harm, or a breakup with a girl, or a moment of discovering pornography. I'm just inviting you to start to think of the story that's been written for you, the story that's shaped you. When men come into counseling, most of the time this is not on the surface. They'll often say things like, oh yeah, there were some weird things that happened when I was a kid, or there were some weird things that happened this one time.
Yes.
And that word weird is often how they hold it.
Yeah.
Or they might say things like, oh my gosh, I plan to take these stories to the grave. I don't know why I'm telling you. So I'm inviting you to be brave with stories that may feel utterly indicting of you. And I'm inviting you to consider, there may be a different story than the one you've concluded, meaning a different plot to that story. It may not be the story that is your indictment. In fact, I can assure you, there is more hope in that story than you believe is true. So be brave with a piece of paper, your journal, the notes app on your phone. I mean, just write out 10 things that have shaped you. And then sit back and let yourself be moved by, what's the story here? Can you hear the places shame was brought in against your innocence or your curiosity? Can you hear where harm happened against you? To start to be curious about what evil's been scripting for you, that would be a huge step. And then to find a place to talk about that, right? A good friend, a mentor, a counselor, a group of guys in your men's group, just a place to have some reflection on that. Obviously with people that are safe and can hold that well with you. The other thing I'd invite you to, and this one might feel, again, a bit more scandalous, but to actually sit down and say, what arouses you? You know, most men that I walk with who struggle with pornography use, as an example, don't type porn into this Google search, right? It's not just porn or not after long, right? Maybe that initial curiosity when you're young, but oftentimes it's a specific type of pornography, meaning something in your arousal schema, so to speak. What arouses you, right? That's often what you type in. That is gold for curiosity. Those words, those set of words that get typed in are a clue, a major clue to parts of your story. Why that? Why did you type in that, right? Again, or just being curious, I think I read somewhere there are like 700 years worth of pornography on one of the major porn sites alone. I mean, that is insane. You could watch for 700 years straight. So, you know, in the act of looking at pornography, you're clicking, right?
Yes.
And that click is being driven by your arousal story and some deeper hunger. So being curious about that click, like it may not be just what you've typed, but then what are you clicking? Again, like my client, the bravery of sitting with, I think I was clicking, looking for a performer with a really genuine smile, right? Like that took bravery, curiosity, being willing to brave sitting with his own arousal and asking those sorts of questions. It could be as well just asking questions around the rhythm and pattern and dance of your sex life with your wife, right? Like, who initiates? How does it go? What's the rhythm? Where is there conflict? And what is the feedback you've been given, right? I'm not saying take it all hook, line, and sinker as truth, but it is for sure worth reflecting on what feedback you're getting from your wife around your sex life. How does it, what's the dance? Because the dance is following a story, and asking questions around that can start to take you into what you're driven by. I'll share this last bit. I was going to Home Depot a couple months ago, and I walk into Home Depot, and there's a guy walking in kind of alongside me, right? We're both going towards the door.
Yeah.
And he's got an I Love MILFs t-shirt on, right? Which is a category of pornography.
Yes.
Mothers.
Yep.
And I won't share the rest, right? But it is basically a sexualized mother.
Right. Right.
And he's got it on a t-shirt.
I want to have sex with a mom. Is the message, right?
Right.
And I love it, and I'm telling the world.
Yes, and this is awesome, and look at me flaunting my sexuality, right? And I thought to myself, like, oh my gosh, if only that guy took that t-shirt to a therapist.
Yes.
Right? Like, he is literally wearing on a shirt his sexual story.
Wow.
I don't know where mothering got sexualized for him.
But his freedom, his life, his joyous peace is hidden in that story.
Right. Like, that would be a great path. I almost walked up to him and said, dude, sexualized mother issues.
I bet that would have went real well.
Right. Like, man, you should go see a counselor about that. But he's also, if you think about it, he's also acting out of contempt.
Yes.
Right? Because think of any mother in that store is going to feel violated.
Absolutely.
He's announcing, I want to have sex with any mother,
right?
A sexualized mother. So if you're a mom in there with kids, that is contempt, right? It is objectifying of mothers. It's not dealing with the issue. But again, right? Like, right there is the contempt next to kindness. If he would take that shirt to a counselor rather than wear it in Home Depot, the difference in his life, right? It's not just throw the shirt away. What a dirtbag. It's, no, dude, like, go down that story. Like, you're right there. Do something with it.
Well, Sam, even in the book, late in it, you have the invitation that the reclamation of our masculine sexuality can help heal the world. It can help change the world. Like, this is actually, in the end, not just for ourselves, but it's for our legacy. It's for our community. And there is so much at stake. And Sam, I just want to close with, you know, in your book, The Sex Talk You Never Got, the tagline is reclaiming the heart of masculine sexuality. And I want to say with all my heart, if a man or a couple takes this to heart, it works. Mm-hmm. With the power of God in community over time, this can get it done. Sam, what a gift, what a privilege to be in this space with you. Just on behalf of these listeners who are like-hearted, I want to say to you, thank you for doing the work. Mm-hmm. Thank you for not teaching beyond what you've lived. Thank you for stewarding what's been entrusted to your own care, not only a message, but a body, a marriage, a family, a vocation, in a community. I commend you, and it's a gift to enter into this work for our own hearts and on behalf of others side by side. Thank you so much for joining me for this podcast. And my friends, my hope is that you will go to Amazon or wherever books are sold and grab a copy of The Sex Talk You Never Got, Reclaiming the Heart of Masculine Sexuality, because it will matter in your life and those entrusted to your care. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Morgan. This has been so good.